members, this morning we're going to hear from the Department of Revenue on the most recent tax incident study, kind of a little summary of who pays Minnesota's taxes. So, Mr. Wilson?
Wilson, Tax Research Division. Tax Incident Study is a large study. We put a lot of time and effort into it. We want you to read it. We want you to understand it. We want it to be used. We want it to be used correctly. So what I hope to do today is to summarize some of the results of the study, but also to give you some perspective, both on the history of these studies as well as on some of the assumptions. Sometimes it's troubling when people try to apply the study. With me at the table is Rato Heisel from the Assistant Director of the NAR Division at the Department of Revenue, who's worked on these studies. Before I start, I do want to thank a couple other people. The project, the team leader on the project is George Temple, who's sitting behind us here, who'll be here for doesn't want to present, but he'll be here to answer questions. Also with him is Aaron Quaint, a new hire who has helped refine and update some things that he's badly needed updating. He's a new guy on the team. Any mistakes are his fault. And I also want to thank Mary Beekner for putting the projects together and work the reports together. She's the one who makes them presentable and readable to you and your staff.
Excuse me, sir, that one's not working. Can you hear me? No. Okay. The study's base year is 2004, so I want to start with the analysis for 2004, the basic results. To some of you, that looks like ancient history, I realize, but that's the base year, the data we have, that's the year we have complete data for, and we start with. We then project the results out to 2009. And so we'll talk about what those predictions show, particularly what's happened or what is expected to happen between 2004 and 2009. And finally, I want to look at the historical trends. These studies go back to 1988 base year, but that wasn't a complete study. So from 1990 to 2009, we have a lot of historical data. You should have a new handout that was in front of you when you came in. This is slightly modified from what was handed out last Thursday. So please do follow along with the one that you have in front of you. Who pays Minnesota's taxes? This is the ninth biennial study. Again, base year is 1988-2004. It includes both state and local taxes. 2004, there were $19.3 billion of state and local taxes collected in Minnesota. In 2009, $25.1 billion are expected to be collected under current law. The report includes both taxes on individuals and taxes on business. And I want to just stop for a second and define what we mean by a business tax. There's a lot of confusion about what business tax means. We define business tax for purposes of this study in a very particular way. An individual tax is either paid directly by an individual, like a motor vehicle registration tax that you would go and pay, or an income tax, or it is a tax that is paid by businesses but is assumed to be fully shifted to consumers in higher prices, such as a cigarette tax. Some earlier studies have assumed or have called the cigarette tax a business tax. That seems to go against the common way we think about these taxes. So when we refer to business tax here, we do not include taxes that are collected by businesses if they're assumed to be passed fully on to consumers in higher prices. Next slide shows taxes, shows business taxes. Notice a couple of things. First of all, this is calendar year data. This study is for a calendar year, not for a fiscal year. And as a result, these numbers, these collections numbers, will not match fiscal year numbers. Just be aware of that. Second thing to notice here is that business taxes make up, by definition, about a third of total taxes. 33.2% of total taxes are business taxes. Business property taxes are counted as business taxes, and that includes the tax on rental property. So all the rental property taxes is included as a business tax in the report. In other cases, it's the tax that's paid on business inputs or on things that businesses buy. So it's not who collects the tax that matters for this definition, but, for example, the motor fuels tax on fuels used by business. If a business the extent that these fuels are purchased by a business, then they have to either cover those costs, bear them themselves, or shift them forward to consumers in prices of their goods. So business tax here means something that's borne in some sense by business and not just passed on to consumers. Notice that 76% of business taxes are the business property taxes and sales tax on business inputs. The corporate franchise tax is much smaller as a burden on businesses. Taxes on individuals are summarized, and again, the motor fuels tax on fuel used by individuals, that portion of the tax is included as an individual tax in the study. And the same thing for a lot of the other taxes. As you can see, those of you who can see the screen, the blue pipe is meant to sort of highlight the definition of business individual. About 2/3 of taxes in Minnesota in 2004 were taxes on individuals by this definition. The income tax was almost half of that revenue, and between the consumer sales tax purchased by consumers and homeowner property taxes, you ended up with about close to 90% of the total taxes on individuals. So the taxes are important, but they're not large compared to those. Tax incidence study starts with a sample. We have a sample of taxpayers. It's a detailed income and tax information for each of 96,000 households. The data, some of that data is very hard data. It's real data. The data on income, the data on income tax paid, the data on homeowner taxes, the PTR numbers, those are real numbers. We know exactly what those people pay in taxes. We know exactly what their income is, or at least we come very close to exactly what their income is. The burdens of the other taxes are estimated. So when we want to estimate, when we look at the sales tax burden, we're estimating that based on consumer expenditure data. So realize it's a mixture of hard data and sort of softer data we're making estimates. Those 96,000 households are blown up or weighted to represent 2.4 million households in the state. It's meant to represent all the households in the state. It's not just those who file income tax, but every household in the state should be represented in the sample or represented in the population. And then the group, then these are divided into 10 groups or deciles, each with 240,000 households. So the first decile has the 240,000 households with the lowest income in the first decile. The 240,000 households with the highest income are in the 10th decile, and those are those with incomes in 2004 of over $105,451.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Mr. Wilson, are those, is that total income or net income?
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, that's total income.
Not taxable income.
It's not just taxable income. The top of the next slide sort of gets to the question, I think, as well. Income in the study includes all cash income. It's not really all income, but it's all cash income. So we start with federal adjusted gross income, but then we add back non-taxable Social Security, non-taxable pension income, non-taxable interest income, workers' compensation cash payments, cash welfare payments, and any other form of non-taxable income that we can find data on. So the income is all cash income. It does not include, though, in-kind assistance. So food stamps is not in here. Housing assistance is not in here. Medical assistance is not in here as in the definition of income. And fringe benefits are not included. And, so it's not as inclusive a definition of income as the Congressional Budget Office uses in their studies or the U.S. Treasury, but it's cash income. I think it's what most people understand when they talk about income. The household definition is a bit of a problem because it differs from the census, and we get questions on this from somebody every time a report comes out. This study shows, as I said, 2.4 million households, a median income of $37,000, 2.1 people on average to a household, and the census is different. 2.05 million households, median income of $51,000, an average person per household of 2.4. And the question is, how can this be right? It doesn't match the census. And the answer is both are correct. Okay. This study defines a household as taxpayer plus a spouse and any dependents. The census defines a household as all who occupy a housing unit. For tax analysis purposes, I think our definition makes more sense. We had a staffer who once referred to these as taxholds, and it may help you to think of these as taxholds rather than households to differentiate them from the census. We have done crosswalks between the census definitions and our definitions, and the numbers do match. Okay, we can explain the differences between them, but think of it as a taxpaying unit. And remember, we do take dependents and match them back to those claiming them as a dependent. So we don't have dependents in here as separate households. Any household that's a single person is a non-dependent for income tax purposes. The results for 2004, the basic results are shown in this slide. Effective tax rate is the taxes divided by income. So what percent of your income do you pay in tax? You'll notice the first decile is very high, 18.9%. It then drops down to 11.3 and 10.5 before rising steadily fairly until you get to the seventh decile at 12.3%. It stays there and then drops in the 10th population decile to 10.9%. And again, that decile is those over 105,000 roughly of income in 2004. The report does also show details for the top 5% and top 1%. And there's a line here because those people are included in the top 10%. So it's not sort of a continuous line, but the top 5% of the population with incomes over 150,000, not puppet, top 5% of households or tax holds, 150,000 and over, and the top 1% of households with over $350,000 pay 10.5 and 9.6% of their income in taxes, according to the estimates in the study. The average overall tax rate, effective tax rate, is 11.6%. Notice that it's lower at the low end in 2, 3, and 4, fourth deciles, and then lower also at the top.
Mr. Wilson, to what extent does that decline in the effective tax rate, to what extent is the fact that they don't pay Social Security after 90-some thousand dollars in income?
Mr. Chair, our study actually ignores federal taxes completely, so this is just state and local taxes only, so it wouldn't be affected by that. If we were looking at the total federal and state and local, we would see something of that sort with Social Security taxes falling, perhaps. But again, and it's a good point to make. This is only state and local taxes, not state and local plus federal. If you look at that, the question is it progressive, is it regressive, is it proportional? A progressive tax has an ETR that rises with income. And if you look at the previous slide, if it's going uphill here, it's progressive. If as your income goes up, your effective tax rate goes up, it's progressive. If it's downward sloping, you're going downhill as income goes up, it's regressive. If it's flat as it is between the seventh and ninth decile, it's proportional. So what is our tax system? Well, it's progressive. It's regressive at the very bottom, then it's progressive for a while, then it's proportional for a while, then it's regressive again. It's nice to have a way to summarize this rather than talking about the mixture. And the summary, to do the summary, we use something called a Suits Index, and you don't need to worry about how it's calculated, but I do want you to get some appreciation for what the Suits Index means. Suits Index is a number between minus 1 and plus 1. If it's plus, it's progressive. It means its tax is progressive. If it's minus, it means it's regressive. And it tries to summarize the entire range of incomes rather than just focusing on one part of it. We calculate them for individual taxes as well as for the total system. For all taxes, the Suits Index in this case is minus 0.024. That means that it is slightly regressive. Now, slightly is in quotes here because what some people call slightly, others may call less than, more than slightly. So, but it's slightly regressive. In other words, the regressivity, and it's particularly the regressivity at the very top, somewhat outweighs the progressivity toward the bottom end. And so we have a system that we would refer to as slightly regressive overall. There are a couple other problems I want to point out. The first decile problem, you'll notice the effective tax rate in the first decile is 18.9%. And as those of you who've been around a while know, we always say, well, just disregard the first decile. We think there are a number of reasons why the first decile overstates the effective tax rate. Some people are there temporarily with business losses that throw them down into a low income for our purposes of measuring the 1 year. And they will have high property taxes and high other things because their typical income is high. That tends to push the effective tax rate up. In other cases, we know income is understated. We haven't really picked up all the sources of income. And because in-kind income is excluded, that also tends to sort of muddy the picture toward the bottom because not all things that you might think of as income are included. On page 17 of the document, there's a more careful discussion of this, and I would encourage you to read that if you have questions about why we sort of say don't pay too much attention to the first decile. There's also a problem at the other end. When you get up over $350,000, the top 1% of the population, when we try to estimate the sales tax paid by very wealthy people, We have difficulty. Our data for doing consumer taxes is pretty good for married couples through about $200,000 of income, and then we have to extrapolate from there. If someone asks me how much sales tax someone with $25 million of income pays, I must admit it is, we do the best we can to estimate that, but we do have difficulty, and there is some question about errors in the consumer taxes at the very top. We know what income tax we pay, we know what homeowner tax they pay, but some of the other taxes that are estimated, when we get to the very top, the income distribution, we do have some difficulties. Again, up to about $350,000, I would say the numbers are fairly good. Beyond that, we do the best we can. We think they are as accurate as possible, but there is some question about how you estimate consumer taxes for people with very high incomes. One final point before moving on to the result, further in the results, is that there are variations within the deciles. You have a mantra, some of you have a mantra that a house is a house is a house. In this study, a household is a household is a household. All households are treated the same, and the basic results just line households up from lowest income to highest income. And yet the households vary, the deciles vary tremendously. This slide shows you the makeup, the distribution of household types within each decile. What you'll notice is at the bottom is you have mostly singles, singles who are not seniors or singles who are seniors. The first three deciles, three-quarters of the population are single-person family, single-person households. At the very top, on the other hand, you have over 90% of the households being married. And when you look at the patterns, they're understandable. Married with children, you'll notice, is very rare at the very bottom of the distribution and becomes over 50% in the top decile. Married with no children sort of explodes toward the top. That's the yellow in the slide on the screen. Seniors are interesting. Single seniors, what looks like it's white on the screen, single seniors are very common in the second, third, and fourth deciles and very uncommon at the top, but but married seniors are much more common in the sixth, seventh, eighth, and ninth decile. So when you look at the results, do keep in mind that you could consider doing analysis that makes more of a distinction among household types. So when we say the median income is $37,560, that's the median overall. But for a married couple with children, nice little sick figures here, for married household with children, the median household is over twice as high at $72,000. A married couple without children, the median income is $69,000. A senior couple, notice the white hair, a senior married couple is $51,000. And a single parent family, the median income is only $24,000. So the distribution of households across deciles varies tremendously, and on pages 60 and 61 of our report this year, we do include information on the taxes paid by the median, and which is right in the middle of each household type, and the first quartile, so 25% are less income and 75% more, and then the third quartile, 75% have less income and 25% more. Some idea what representative households are paying in taxes to give a better feel for what these numbers mean and whether they're reasonable. I think the problem with a household as a household as a household is that the results sometimes don't seem reasonable. And if you look at the representative household results, it seems to make more sense. As we said, the overall tax system, state and local taxes, is regressive, slightly regressive. There's only one major tax that's progressive, which is the income tax in green. Upward sloping, it starts with a negative tax because of refundable credits, and it goes up to a top tax rate of 6% in the 10th population decile. Notice that the Suits index for that is plus 0.219. If you try to get an idea of what Suits indexes mean, if you sort of think of that picture, that's plus 0.2, okay? On the other hand, consumer sales tax is minus 0.17, and you can see what that slope looks like there. You get a feel for, when we talk about a regressive tax, what does it look like? How rapidly is the effective tax rate falling as incomes go up? Homeowner property taxes here are before PTR. It doesn't say that, but this is before property tax refunds, and we'll look at the effect of property tax refunds in a minute. So the overall effect is close to zero for Suits, but it's a mixture of Suits, a mixture of regressivity and progressivity, and in some real sense, it's the overall system-wide progressivity that is of greatest interest rather than the progressivity of any one individual tax. It's the system as a whole that people would look at, or rather than worrying too much about one particular tax. There's an alternative way to present the data, and some of you like this much more than the way that it's been presented so far. As I've said, on the left-hand side, you can see the four green boxes that are shaded at the top there. The population deciles divide the entire sample, the entire population, into 10 groups with equal population, 10% of the population, 240,000 households in each group. Notice that the first decile, while it has 10% of the population, only has 1% of the income. And the top decile, while it has 10% of the population, has 40% of the income. So we haven't divided the income up equally. We've divided the population up equally. On the right-hand side are income deciles. And some people like this perspective more. You divide households up so that each group of the 10 groups has equal income. So 10% of the income is in the first income decile. 10% of the income is in the second income decile. Notice the first income decile, while it has 10% of the income, it has 38% of all households. The top income decile, while it has 10% of the income, it has 0.3% of the population. Now, you can think about this as a pepperoni pizza, which is why that pizza's in the middle, in case you're wondering. It's a pepperoni pizza. How do you slice the pie? You can slice the pie and think about pepperoni pizza, where the pepperoni is very unevenly distributed on the top of the pizza. So you can slice the pizza so that you have equal size pieces. That's population deciles. Or if you really care more about pepperoni, you could slice the pizza so that you have the same amount of pepperoni on each slice. And some slices would be very small, but with a lot of pepperoni on them, and that's more like income deciles. Neither one is more right than another, but there's more detail at lower incomes when you use population deciles. There's more detail at upper incomes when you use income deciles. My own preference, in some ways, is population deciles, but only if we show top 5 and top 1% as well. In other words, we do get some more detail at the top when we have 5 and 1%. Otherwise, if you want more detail at the top, the income deciles are important. The next slide shows what the income deciles look like, and notice a couple of things. First, you don't have a first decile problem with income deciles. That's sort of nice. It's 11.8%. It's not real high because you have put four deciles together, four population deciles. You've crammed them into one income decile. On the right-hand side, you have much more detail on the top population decile. The top population decile is really distributed across four income deciles. And so that decline at the top is much more noticeable when you use income deciles. The average there is 10.9%, but of course it goes from 11.9 down to 9.2 when you divide that into smaller pieces. So again, neither one is more nor less right. It's just a different way of slicing the pie, a different way of looking at the numbers. This is just the contrast. The next slide was just the contrast again with the population deciles, so you could see them on one slide and on one page and compare them. A couple other comments about the 2004 data. We have a number of ways that we try to keep our tax system in Minnesota progressive, or at least less regressive, and one is refundable credits on the income tax. This slide shows the impact of refundable credits. The blue line is what the income tax would look like if we didn't have the refundable credits. The refundable credits are the working family credit, dependent care credit, and the K-12 credit. If we didn't have those, we would look like the blue line. And the refundable credits bring it down to the brown line. So refundable credits reduce income tax burdens a lot at the bottom for the first four deciles and a little bit for the fifth decile. They actually take the income tax burden negative because you can have a refundable amount that exceeds what you're paying in tax. And notice that the Suits Index without the credits would be 0.189, which is still positive but not as progressive as the plus 0.219. It only reduces the effective tax rate from 4.3% to 4.2%, but it has a significant effect on the distribution of the burden of the income tax, and it makes the overall system more progressive. The same thing is true for the property tax refunds on the next slide. You can see the impact of property tax refunds on residential taxes. I would comment that the residential taxes here include rental property tax as well as homeowners. There's a note that it says excludes cabins, so it's basically homeowners and renters. And what you see there is that without the PTR, we have a property tax system which on residential property is more regressive than the sales tax. At minus 0.180, sales tax about minus 0.170, so roughly the same as the sales tax. But with the PTR, we have a system that, while still regressive, is a lot less so. So the regressivity of the sales tax, and notice that, regressivity of the property tax on residential housing is quite a bit less because of the PTR. And this, again, is 2004. Property tax, we'll see, it was expanded quite a bit by 2009.
Mr. Wilson.
Property tax refund program.
Mr. Wilson. Senator Dibble.
Senator Steven.
Oh, Steven, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wilson, is the PTR for people who apply for it or for anyone who's eligible?
Mr. Chair, Senator Steven, the PTR here is this PTR actually received. So this is the amount people would get who actually have applied for it. So this is actual values received. The participation rate in the property tax refund is not 100%, so it's only for those who receive it. And this does not include the effect of the market value credit for those of you who are involved with property tax taxes more. Market value credit is included in the blue line. It's already been taken out before you get to the blue line. So this is only showing the effect of the property tax refund itself. What happens between 2004 and 2009? I think the simple story between these 2 years is the taxes go up slightly and become more regressive. The average tax rate, average effective tax rate in 2009 is projected to be 11.7% under current law, up from 11.6%. Some increase in the average effective tax rate. In addition, the suits index goes from minus 0.024 to minus 0.032. I'll talk a little later about whether that's significant or not, whether that's large enough to matter. But do notice that it becomes more regressive. With population deciles, the tax rate goes up in every decile, goes up the most in the third decile and the fourth decile, and fifth decile, I guess, too. It goes up in every decile except the 10th, where it drops slightly. So when the effective tax rates are going up in every decile except the top one, which is going down, it will make the tax structure slightly more regressive. And again, the top 5% and top 1% as well. So the basic results of the projection out to 2009 is to expect slightly higher taxes as percent of income and slightly more regressive taxes as well.
Mr. Wilson, in the top 1%, you show their effective tax rate continuing to go down. Is that because their personal income is growing faster than their tax burden, or what's happening there?
Mr. Chair, I actually think the easiest explanation is their income is growing faster than their taxes, and I think there is some validity to that, the projection of 2009 shows capital gains taxes, for example, capital gains income being quite a bit higher in 2009 than it was in 2004 based on the economic forecast. And so to some extent, these high-income people are becoming even more high-income. There are some trends also in the tax structure that may exacerbate that a little bit in terms of sales taxes going to sales tax being smaller as people's income goes up as well. But it is not particularly tax policy that's driving this because the tax law changes between 2004 and 2009, aside from property taxes at the local level, which are in the projections here. But the other tax laws are pretty much unchanged. We have not had an income tax rate change. We haven't had major changes to sales tax between those years. So this is primarily economic growth doing this to the system.
So, Mr. Wilson, it is true the rich get richer.
Between 2004 and 2009, that is certainly true. Yeah. And we will actually take a look in a later slide at sort of some numbers to show that, to illustrate that. We have one slide here, which is an addendum, okay? This tax incentive study is a tax incentive study. We do not include fees. However, at the time the health impact fee was enacted, we were asked if we would show the impact of the health impact fee on the tax incentive study, and this slide does that. This is shown in the report as well in Chapter 4. If we had included the health impact fee, the 75 cents per pack health impact fee, if that had been included in this study, the effective tax rate would have risen in the bottom deciles and would have not changed really noticeably. It would have just been a rounding error in the top decile. It looks like a small change on the slide. This is basically 1% of tax revenues being increased here, so you're not going to see a huge increase. It does make the tax system less more regressive. So at the bottom, you'll notice with taxes only, we have minus 0.032 for the Suits Index for 2009. If HIF were included, it would be minus 0.038 instead, which is a fairly, well, we'll take a look at how significant that is, but a fairly significant reduction in the Suits Index. In looking at what happened between 2004 and 2009, just a couple quick slides here. State taxes are projected to actually go down as a percent of income, from 8.8% of income to 8.5% of income, and stay about as equally progressive. So the basic story here is state taxes are going down, and in the next slide, local taxes are going up. And local taxes are going up from 2.9% of income on average to 3.2% of income on average, and they're becoming more regressive in the study as well. The local share of state and local taxes between 2004 and 2009 is projected to rise from 25.8% to 28.5%. So the share of taxes paid collected locally rather than at the state level is projected to rise considerably between 2004 and 2009. Probably no surprise there in terms of the patterns. On individual taxes, a couple things are noted. First of all, the effective tax rate on the individual income tax is projected to go up from 4.2% on average to 4.4% on average. And you may not realize that you have enacted an increase in tax rates for the income tax. You may not recall that because you didn't do it. This is simply the effect of economic growth. This is the effect of increasing income. It's what economists often refer to as bracket creep. As incomes go up, the tax system is indexed for inflation, but if your income grows faster than inflation, the percent of your income you pay in tax will actually rise as your income goes up. 4.4%, by the way, is comparable to 4.5% effective tax rate in the individual income tax in 1998 before the income tax rates were cut. So bracket creep in this sense does through time increase the basically increases the share of the income tax in the overall system and increases the tax average tax rates on income tax. This is purely economic growth here, nothing else. Sales tax goes the opposite way. Economic growth with higher incomes, higher real incomes above inflation, reduces sales tax revenues as a percent of income. The sales tax base is lower as a share of income for people with higher income, and as your income goes up, you're going to pay a smaller and smaller share of your income in sales tax revenues. You save more, and you also spend more on non-taxable items and services in particular. So the average sales tax rate goes down from 2.8% to 2.5%. Again, this is mostly just an effect of economic growth. This is somewhat clouded because this does include motor vehicle sales taxes, and those are down considerably. So part of this is due to motor vehicle sales tax decline with sales down since 2004. Homeowner property tax goes way up. This is after PTR now. The red line is, the solid line is the 2004 property tax, homeowner property tax as a percent of income after PTR, and you can see what happens in between 2004 and 2009. These are projected numbers in 2009 based upon the economic, the numbers in the price of government report, basically, for local governments. You notice it goes up quite a bit. The taxes rise faster than income. Homeowner property taxes are up 45% over this period of time, while income was up 30%. So that's going to rate. When income goes up 30% and taxes go up 45%, it will raise the effective tax rate for that tax. Homeowner property tax refunds are up, I think, 44% over this period of time, which is why there's not such a big an effect at the bottom end. Homeowner property taxes, the property tax refunds, rather, have in fact kept up with the increase in property taxes at the lower end. At least that would be my interpretation of why the lower end has not dropped, has not risen relative to the top. And do notice the percent change at the top may be a little bit less. That's why the Suits Index for the property tax is getting more regressive, as well as the average tax rising. There's not much of a story on business taxes. They're changing a bit. They're going down very, very slightly. There's no story to tell here, really. But it's the other large category of tax. Let's turn finally to history. The history of effective tax rates. This is the report. This is the results of all the studies that were done except for the 1988 base year, which did not include business taxes, so it's not really comparable. You'll notice 1992 through 1998, it says ADJ at the bottom. These numbers were adjusted from what was reported in the early studies because they excluded some taxes that were in existence at that time, and we've gone back and tried to adjust the results, at least fairly roughly. It will give you the right results for this kind of an overall thing for the taxes that were not included. For example, gambling taxes were not included in the early studies and were added later on. The same thing was true of a few other significant taxes. So these are comparable numbers across the years. The first thing to notice is that in 2004, the 11.6% average effective tax rate for the population as a whole is higher than it was in 2002 and higher than it was in 2000. So the effective tax rates are going up, and they're going to go up another little notch projected for 2009. On the other hand, 2009, as projected in this study, even if you were to include the HIF in it, even if you did that, it would still be below any of the years in the 1990s. So the effective tax rates, according to this study, are lower than they were in the 1990s, but they are increasing from the lowest point in 2000.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead. Excuse me. Mr. Wilson, when you were doing this graph here, do you have any feel for how many dollars it takes to move the effective tax rate up a tenth of a percent? Do you have any feel for that?
I could.
Well, just rough. I don't.
Well, in the study itself, in the study it shows total income. So total income is. Total income is $139 billion. So $139 billion to raise that by a tenth of a percent would be $139 million then. So $139 million would raise it by a point by 0.1%. I think is my math right?
Thank you.
I hope that's right.
But
you can calculate that directly from the study.
Mr. Chair.
Alexa.
Mr. Chair, now that 11.7%, why is that a lot different than the price of government? What isn't in here that's in the price of government?
Mr. Chair, Senator Langseth, it's a very good question. I'm glad you asked it because it's a point I meant to make and didn't make earlier. The price of government includes quite a few things that are not in here. The price of government includes things that are not taxes. So even tuition and fees at the university are included in the price of government, and non-tax revenue is included. Fees are included. So a lot of things that are not taxes. But you can look at the tax line in the price of government. There is a line for taxes as well in the price of government. These numbers will not match up perfectly. And the main reason for that is that we are looking at the burden that is paid by Minnesotans. And it's not a large proportion, but a significant proportion of the tax that we're estimating is being exported to non-residents. So the price of government just looks at what's collected. It doesn't look at what portion is paid by residents of Minnesota. These numbers should be a little lower than in the price of government, but shouldn't be. They should be consistent, but that's why they would be lower. On the other hand, if you look at the overall price of government, you're including non-tax revenue as well as sort of all own source funds, all own source revenue rather than just taxes. The next slide is here just to amuse you, okay? you can't make sense of this, but this is plotting every study that's been done since 1990. It is interesting. If you look at it, you can tell that the highest tax rates, if you look at the colors, that sort of lavender and the light blue, those are 1994 or 1996, which you'd expect to be the highest. The lowest sort of show up as being 2002, 2000, and 1990, interestingly enough, which is not listed as the lowest overall. The other thing that I really want to point out here, though, is if you look out to the right-hand side, you'll notice that a couple of these are fairly flat in the 10th decile. 1990, which is in black, 1992, which may not show up, but which is in yellow, and 1994, which is in light blue, begins to turn down. But that drop in the 10th decile is not something that showed up in the earliest studies that were done. If we look at some of these studies, if you look at the net change over 17 years, if we compare just 1992 to 2009, two things are striking in the pattern. In 1992, we had a fairly horizontal, once we got past first decile, a horizontal, a proportional tax system. The suits was 0.004, or adjusted as 0.007, but unadjusted 0.004. almost zero. The change since then is twofold. First of all, refundable credits and improvements, increases in the property tax refund, expansion of the property tax refund, have taken the effective tax rate relatively lower in the second, third, and to some extent fourth decile. On the other hand, the 10th decile has clearly dropped below the average for the other deciles. So the pattern has changed quite a bit over that period of time. Why that has happened is not something that is easy to sort out. And I do want to talk a little bit about why that change may have occurred historically. One thing that was commented on earlier about the rich getting richer, et cetera, is that we can look at the effective tax rates for everyone, which is the top line here. It's been unadjusted because I can't adjust the top 5 and 1% rate. So it's unadjusted for some of those changes in the early years. But the top 5 and 1%, and notice how the variation increases. If you look at the red line, the second line down, and compare it to the top line, the difference between those two goes from 0.8% in 1996 down to, in 1998, down to 1.7%, which was the maximum difference. But what I think the slide shows is there have been significant swings in the distribution of income within the state of Minnesota over this period of time. This is before tax income. This is not due to tax policy particularly. This is due to changes in the state economy. 2002, you'll notice that difference went up and became back toward a minimum. That was a recession year, basically. And so the top incomes came down more than the average incomes in percentage terms. So the difference is smaller in then. This is effective tax rate, but it's affected, in other words, by the distribution of income and the degree of equality or inequality in that income. So when you start looking at these patterns through time, it's important to realize that some of it's due to tax policy, but not all of it. Some of it is just due to the economy. And the economy changing, income distribution changing, and that will change what our Suits Index looks like, what our diagrams look like, what the distribution of the burden looks like, quite independent of tax policy. If we look through a couple of years here, 1992 to 1996, you see that pattern developing. Tax rates went up on average, but you begin to get that sort of a hill shape between the second and the 10th decile. It's much more extreme in 1998, which was, again, the year with the greatest inequality in income, as we saw. And again, what was going on in 1998? This was a stock market boom. We had very high capital gains income. We had other sources of income at the top, which were very very high at that point. And so the downturn at the top is largely, I would say, driven by, there weren't any big changes in income tax law or anything between 96 and 98. Law changes play a role in this, but the biggest impact here is just the distribution of income. And again, the pattern in between 1998 and 2000, income taxes were cut, motor vehicle registration taxes were cut. However, income taxes only went down by 0.2% of income overall, and the change here is 0.8% of income, a drop, so that this is not all tax policy, although I think the income tax cuts certainly had a role to play in the change between 1998 and 2000. And finally, between 2000 and 2004, at least, there's not much. I mean, the pattern stays the same. It's a little less, a little lower drop at the top than it was in 2000, which, again, was still a stock market boom year. Finally, if we just look at the Suits Index, and again, this is looking at the history here. You look at these Suits Indexes, and you say, well, I don't know what that means. Minus 0.007, minus 0.04, is that big or not? Are these big changes or are these tiny changes? How do I know whether the change is significant or not in terms of the size of the impact on the distribution of the tax burden? I want to talk a little bit about what a big change is, but I want to point out one other thing on the page that you're looking at now. You have the Suits Index in the top by year showing, and again, negative numbers. The more negative, the more regressive the tax structure. So it becomes most regressive in 1998. And also close to that in 2000 and 2009. And then the next lowest is 2004. You have 3 years that look very much the same, 2002, 1996, and 1992. And you have the lowest 2 years, the least inequality in 1990 and 1994. This is the tax system. This is our Suits Index for the overall burden of the tax distribution. The next slide below that shows the income share of the top 5%. What I want you to notice is that the year when the Suits Index is the lowest, the most regressive, are the same years exactly that have the highest share of income going to the top 5%. It's almost a perfect fit. If you do a correlation between these two sets of data, again, you don't have to know how you used to do it, but if you do a correlation, you get 0.96. Okay, now minus 0.96. That's about as close to perfect correlation as you can get, because minus 1 would be perfect correlation. What this suggests is that it's at least, it doesn't suggest that it's only the economy and not tax policy, but it suggests that the distribution of income before taxes has a huge impact on the Suits Index, on the distribution of the burden of taxes. I put this slide in, it's slide 14 again, and you don't need to turn to it, but this slide was the income deciles, and I want you just to understand, if you suddenly increase the income of the people in the top four deciles there and stretch that out to the right a bit, in other words, think about those people in particular who's getting richer, obviously their average tax rate's going to fall. And when their average tax rate falls, because as income goes up, the average tax rate falls, when that happens, it's going to make the picture look more regressive. So when you have high stock market income, high capital gains at the top of the income distribution, that when the income distribution is highly unequal, you're going to see the Suits Index go down, become more regressive. So one of the points I want to make is just simply, it's very hard to tease what the effect of tax policy is between these years, because it's mixed in with the effect of economic distribution of income due to economic factors. How big is a suit change is big? Well, let's look back up at the Suits Index on slide 34. The swings there are pretty big, minus 0.01 to minus 0.04. I mean, maybe that's not big, but it's minus 0.03. Okay, it's swinging by 0.03. Or between 1998 and 2002, it's swinging by 0.022. What is 0.022? Is that big? Well, take a look at what some tax policies would do to our Suits Index in 2004, and you get a feel for what big means. In other words, my argument is these are fairly significant, fairly large swings in the Suits Index, because it would take a lot of tax policy to bring them about. Slide 37, got two slides, look like this. The first one is titled Interpreting a Suits Index Change. In other words, what's it take to change, to shift a Suits Index? If you raise income taxes across the board, this is a progressive tax. If you were just to raise income taxes across the board by 10%, you would raise the Suits Index by 0.009. Okay, now that's about half of the swing we saw between 2000 and between 1998 and 2002. So again, it takes a lot of policy. In other words, if you raise the income tax only in the top decile by 250 million in 2004, again, this is 2004, not 9, you would raise the Suits Index by 0.006. Okay, again, relatively large, but not large relative to those swings in historical swings. If you cut the sales tax, the regressive tax, by 0.5% to 6%, you replace it with a higher income tax, just dollar for dollar replace the revenues, you'd get a change in the Suits Index of 0.008. And if you cut home owner property taxes by 20%, there's a little problem with the PTR here, but just roughly, you'd get about a 0.004 increase in the Suits Index. So those things do change the distribution of the tax burden. But again, think about, these are large tax changes, and they have changes that are smaller than the swings we've seen historically in these years. If you want to reduce the sale, not that the goal would be, but things that would reduce the Suits Index, make it more regressive, would be increase the state sales tax rate to 7%. Sales tax is more regressive than the overall tax system, so you'd make the overall tax system more regressive by 0.002. Increasing the gas tax by 5 cents a gallon would do the same. Increase the cigarette tax by 75 cents per pack, we saw, would make a change of minus 0.006. And if you eliminated the entire PTR, both homeowner and renter, and all refundable income tax credits, if you just blew them all away, your suits would go down by minus 0.016, and the 2004 suits would look like the 1998 suits of minus 0.04. So I give these to you give an appreciation for the kinds of policy changes it would take to swing the Suits Indexes. I think the Suits Index is one of these things that's so hard to understand what it means, what the magnitudes mean, that it's important to sort of put it in perspective and think about tax policy changes. And I guess it gets back a little bit to Senator Scully's question about, you know, how big a change would it take to change a tenth of a percent. This is how big a change would it take to change the Suits Index, to change the regressivity of the tax system. Just two more quick points, and I will be done. One more quick point, really, which is, I can go back.
Senator, go ahead.
On the Suits Index, so just so I understand that, that's kind of a way you're adding up all of the differing graphs that we've looked at and putting them into one number. Am I kind of getting a feel for what that is? And then if you start tipping those different lines, this is the change that you can see?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scully, that's correct. The Suits Index is just an index number. It's just a summary number to summarize the entire picture, basically, on those. And if it, to get the SUTS index to go up towards zero, you've got to make that those lines more upward sloping somewhere. To make them go down, you would make them more downward sloping. And so it's trying to measure the size of the change in the slopes in the diagrams.
Thank you.
The problem is since it goes up and then down first, then up and then down again, it's sort of hard to summarize it even by looking at the pictures sometimes. And it's sort of a way to summarize the overall effect. And you don't want to know how it's calculated. So. One warning on business taxes, and I did give you a sales tax change and a motor vehicles tax change on the previous slides, and they are partly business taxes, and I didn't do them quite correctly, I must admit. I think that for this purpose they were all right, but the problem with the business taxes, and you don't need, I'm not going to try to explain how we do the business taxes, how we shift, what we do about the assumption about how much is shifted forward in prices and how much is shifted backward to labor and how much is borne by the owners of capital. If you want an explanation of that, the easiest, clearest explanation I can come up with is on pages 73 to 84 of the report. And I really would encourage, if you're interested in why these results for business taxes look like they do, to take a look at that, what method we've used. That part of the report is almost the same as was originally written in 1990, for the 1990 report, or the 1990 base year, 1993. So we haven't changed the methodology much since there, except for some very small refinements. This study assumes that all states impose their taxes at one time. So if you think about business taxes, they're being imposed not just in Minnesota, but in other states at the same time. And so it's the relative taxes between Minnesota and other states that matter for business tax purposes. And as a result, when you put all taxes in all states on at one time, and you have to look at comparing ourselves to other states to look at the incidence of the tax, business taxes, and how much can be shifted forward in prices, and how much is going to be forced back on labor, or how much will be borne by the owners of capital. In the study, we break the tax on capital into three parts. The first part is the average tax on national capital for all capital, sort of, for that tax. And then we look at the sector, like an individual sector, the utility sector, or some subcomponent of the manufacturing sector, and we say, well, what's the average tax across the country for that tax on that sector? And the difference, if that is higher than the average tax on all capital, then that's the sector differential. And then we look at the Minnesota differential. How much higher are we than the average taxes in that sector across the country? We break into the three parts, and the three parts are then allocated differently depending upon the nature of the market, because some markets you can raise prices in and some you can't. My point here is a quite simple one. If you look in the incident study, you're getting results that are for that kind of a model where all states are changing their taxes and putting them in at one time. It's in some sense the average incidence of the existing tax. If you change the tax, the incidence of an incremental change in a business tax, this is not true for individual taxes, but for business taxes, the incidence of incremental change in business taxes will differ from the average shown in the study. And it will differ considerably. This is sort of an ugly graph, but I wanted to point out what the differences are. On the left-hand side, you have apartments. Now, for apartments, this study actually assumes that landlords bear a considerable portion of the tax on apartments. 45% of the tax, on average, is borne by the renter, and 55% is borne by the landlord. This was not true, by the way, when our apartment taxes were very high compared to national averages, but we've reduced apartment taxes quite a bit. So relative to the national average, and for investors who are looking at investing in property. But if you were to change the tax, the only part of the tax we would assume is borne by the landlord when you raise this tax is the tax on land. The portion of tax on land, we would assume, as most economists do, that that's borne by the landlord, but the rest of it would be shifted forward in rent. So 82%, I think, of any increase in rental property taxes would be shifted to renters. So the distribution, the burden on rental property tax is going to look very different if you change the tax than if you look at the averages in this report. Similarly, if you look over at the far right-hand side for industrial property taxes, in industrial property taxes, and this report is largely exported to non-residents, the burden of the tax. That's because a lot of it is assumed to be borne by stockholders, and stockholder ownership is out of state to a large extent. And as a result, that tax actually, if you look at that tax evaluation, you say, well, that's pretty good. Why shouldn't we just raise taxes on industrial property because it's all being exported? On the other hand, if you were to increase that tax, the share being exported goes down considerably from something like 80% to about 33%. And the pressure it would put on employers would be shown up in the long run, we would argue, in the report, the methodology would be to push down wages because of competitive pressures. And Minnesota labor would effectively bear 54% of that tax given when we got full adjustment. The point here is just simply don't look at the business taxes in this report and just assume that you can use those incident study reports to look at the effect of a change in those taxes. We can help you with that if someone has questions on it, but basically the incidence is very different, and it's very misleading to sort of use those to evaluate changes in business taxes. The incidence assumptions can be challenged. They are, you know, what we assume here is consistent with economic theory in some long-run equilibrium sense. They can be challenged, but they're the same assumptions we've used throughout these reports from the very beginning. And so it's just a warning. So in conclusion, again, the study shows results for 2004. It shows projections for 2009, and I'm hoping these results have helped with the interpretation and raise some questions in your mind that you can share with us as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Wilson, with regard to just the CI property tax portion, is that appears to be about the same regressivity as the regular property tax, or is there is CI property taxes have a different regressivity than the homestead property taxes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scully, if we look in the report on page 25, you'll see the details for each tax in terms of a suit index. Again, the suit index is the only way really to summarize these easily. But if you look under local taxes at the bottom, I know some of this is a state tax too, but you'll see the same results for the state tax. So on page 25, under local taxes toward the bottom, commercial property tax, industrial property tax, you'll see that the commercial tax is minus the suits index going across to the far right-hand side. It's minus 0.135. That is slightly less regressive than the overall property tax. But this is before PTR. I think if the home part of it you put after PTR, you might see them being roughly equivalent. On the other hand, the industrial property tax on industrial property is actually shown up as being progressive in this case. But that's, again, because the portion of the tax that's borne in Minnesota is sufficiently on the again, it's this average versus if you change it, you're not going to get that same result. But in this case, it actually shows being slightly progressive. Our industrial property taxes have fallen quite a bit relative to national averages, and so a lot of it's being borne now by the owners, basically. And those are allocated in most part by the ownership of stock or by dividends. So so it turns out looking like a progressive tax. And, again, the warning here is just the change in tax wouldn't be the same pattern.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Wilson, so what I would take from that, if we were to rebalance property taxes a little bit off of homeowners onto CI, it might actually make the tax more progressive and less regressive.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scully, we could certainly look at that. I don't have an answer off the top of my head on exactly which way it would go. It depends a little bit on how you do it, too, if you were to if you shift taxes off of if you're going to shift them onto CI property, we could take a look at that and see what the effect would be.
Yeah, no, thank you, Mr. Wilson. Mr. Chair, I was just looking at this and I see that, you know, and as Mr. Wilson has said, that they appear to be more progressive than the homeowner, so it's something to keep in mind.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Just following along, what you were saying is often those new taxes get passed along to the labor force, and so you're going to study that and get back to us on whether it would be more regressive or more progressive to change the property tax burden from residences to the CI index.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, we can show you what the study would look like if those taxes had been in place would be in place in 2009. So we can do that. The study's assumptions are that you have reached an equilibrium in some sense. And so If you raise tax on business, it may take a little while for the adjustment to take place. You're not going to see an instant impact. In the very short run, the owners are going to have to pay the tax. So the shifting takes some time. But we can look at the impact of that, how the incident study would have looked differently if we had had that in effect. And that's the kind of analysis we can do for you. Certainly, and one of the things to emphasize is certainly the goals of good tax policy are much broader than just the distribution of the tax burden. The study focuses on the distribution of the tax burden, but obviously there are other goals. Simplicity is a goal. Competitiveness is a goal. So there are other goals of the tax system besides the distribution of burden across income groups. But we can certainly do that kind of analysis. The results will depend upon the methodology we use, so it would be consistent with the methodology we've used in the studies in the past.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, this committee is considering a major shift to the business property tax, and I'm wondering if we actually gave you the proposal, if you could take that proposal and study that, or is that too limited a view for the purposes of your tax incident study?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, we can certainly take a look at it. Some parts of proposals are much harder to model than others. But when you make big, if you're making big changes between different types of policies, that is the kind of different kinds of taxes. That is the kind of analysis the incident study should help with. So, it's not a case where every little tax proposal that comes along. But when you're talking about major restructuring of taxes, that's the kind of analysis that is useful, and so we don't want to encourage extra work. You have worked us, you and your colleagues in the House have worked us plenty hard this session already. So we're not looking for work, but that is the kind of analysis that I think the incident study is designed to be.
Mr. Chair,
well,
just
Mr. Wilson, I think along Senator Ortman's line of thinking, the state property tax, which is, I believe, is what we're considering, is less regressive than cabin taxes. It's less regressive than homeowners' taxes.
Mr. Chair, again, the only warning is that we would have to look at that as an incremental change in tax, so it may not flow through with on the average numbers you see in the report. And that's why the report itself is not, for looking at that kind of question, the report itself is not nearly as useful as it may appear at first glance. So we really would need to take a look at what the effect would be if we had changed those taxes and put them into the report to begin with. So. And Mr. Chair, we can do that kind of analysis.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I think we've gotten to a defining moment in the Senate Tax Committee. The question is, do we really want to know how this change will impact Minnesotans, or do we just want to say that it's a good shift, and that it's going to be make the system more progressive? Do we really want to know? And I think I want to know, and I'd like to see what the report would show if we proposed what came out of the tax property tax subcommittee on Friday.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoy.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, I think also we could get a definition of what major is, because when you look at the total local taxes, we're talking about $6 billion, and we proposed a couple hundred million dollars in change. That would be, I think it's less than 1%, probably less than 0.5%. So that would be what we'd have to, also figure into this. And as Mr. Wilson's graph on suits showed, it takes a, pretty significant change to affect the suits rating. And I don't know if that percentage change would affect it very much or not, but it certainly seems to me that the direction we need to go is try to figure out to get this more progressive and try to flatten it out, and so we take a small incremental step toward doing that.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I would say that looking at the numbers at $220 million for the next biennium and $466 million for the following biennium is a significant change. Now, whether that changes the suits index significantly, I'm not sure, but I would think that it would. But I'd sure like to know, especially before I'm told
that it will make the system more progressive, because I think we've just been warned that it might not make the system more progressive, and I don't want to hear it's more progressive as a justification unless we're really sure. I mean, that's why I say this is a defining moment. Do we really want to know? Then if we really want to know, then I think we should ask the Department of Revenue to take the proposal that came out of the tax committee, the property tax subcommittee on Friday, and ask them, will it make the system more progressive or not?
Senator Ortman, I think the long-term, the problem is the long-term trend line. When you have business taxes that are pegged to a number plus inflation and all other types of property set on market value, there's going to be different trend lines. I would argue that all classes of property should be based on market value, that there shouldn't be some preferential treatment for one kind or another that's just based on inflation. So I think that's the more long-term trend line issue, is should they all be set on market value or not? I think that's what we discussed in the division. Mr. Wilson, thank you very much. Anything further to conclude?
Mr. Chair, I should clarify one point. In looking at business taxes, the thing we can do is we can compare what would have been true had that been done in 2004. The problem with doing the analysis for 2009 is we'd have to know what the average taxes are in other states, and we do not have that information for 2009. So there really, it really does create some problems with how you interpret it. But we can look at those questions. But it's not a case of just putting numbers in and spotting numbers out. So my warning, I think, is important. If we get a request, we will consider what we can do with it. But we don't. If other states are raising their taxes on property and we raise ours, that's a different effect than if we do it alone. And so that's the problem with doing this in the 2009 year.
Well, Mr. Wilson, just one last thing. Is it fair for me to conclude that the share of the overall taxes that businesses pay is going to decline from 2004 to 2009?
Mr. Chair, I believe that is correct, and the number is in the share of business taxes, 33.2% of total state and local taxes in 2004. This is the top of page 11 in the report, which shows the figure 1.3 shows the share of individual taxes versus, in the term households here means individual taxes versus business taxes. And you can see that the business share in 2004 was 33.2%. That is projected to fall to 32.3% in 2009. So that is a correct assertion.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Senator Carlson here.
Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Chair, I think if you look at the federal tax revenue, it's very progressive. And to a large extent, the federal kind of preempts state and local as far as the income tax is concerned. I think you'd probably find that every state in the United States has a regressive system. Some are less regressive than others. Maybe ours is less regressive than others. But I think the fact that the federal government has a high income tax and does tax well-to-do people quite high kind of keeps the state and local out of that to a large extent.
Well, I think, Senator Langstroth, the troubling thing for me is the projections are between 2004 and 2009 that our system is going to become more regressive. I think that's the challenge I think this committee has to try and make sure that over time we aren't building a more regressive tax system. Senator Carlson has in front of the committee Senate File 1843. It's a tax increment financing proposal for the city of Eagan. Senator Carlson, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair and committee. This bill which is Senate File 1843, authorizes the City of Eagan to establish an economic development tax increment financing district. And what it mainly does and why we need the enabling legislation is that there are some exemptions that we need to have in it, in that the TIF statutes generally are more favorable to manufacturing and not the knowledge worker or the preparing work sites for employees. So what we need to do is we need to have a special variance, which is this Senate File 1843. And I have the mayor of Eagan, Mr. Mike McGuire, to speak to the bill. So I'd like to introduce Mayor Mike McGuire.
Thank you. Morning, Chair Bach and committee. Thank you for the opportunity to address a bill before you today regarding the City of Eagan's request for the authority to consider providing public financing assistance to Thompson West for its proposed expansion of facilities on its Eagan campus. The City Council's support of a resolution in support of the legislation was unanimous, reflecting the value that the city places on Thompson's role in our local economy and recognizing the importance that it plays in our regional and state economies as well. As you know, the kind of investments and jobs represented in the potential expansion of the Thompson facility in Eagan is exactly the kind of economic development that the state of Minnesota strives for. In addition to $100 million in physical investment, this proposal would create 2,000 technology-focused jobs. Those are head of household jobs, brain power jobs, all in one single project. The impact of the development and those jobs will be felt throughout the state's economy many times over and for years to come. Despite the scale and importance of the project, the legislation that we are seeking would not grant broad additional authority to the city to provide financial support for economic development. Current TIF laws would permit the city to create a 9-year economic development tax increment district of this kind for a comparable business expansion if it were a traditional manufacturer. Manufacturing is important to Minnesota because it adds value, and creates physical products that can be sold anywhere and attract income to the state. Thompson is a manufacturer of software, legal research, and intellectual products that add value and attract income from around the world. The fact that this production occurs in an office on a computer and not on an assembly line or on a factory floor is a reality of our economy today, an information and technology-based economy that Minnesota is and should be competitive in. The legislation we are asking you to support would recognize the fact and permit Eagan to consider this financing tool as a means of partnering with Thompson West. I appreciate your willingness to consider this legislation and ask that you support it today and as it moves through both the Senate and the House. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Question, Senator Moore.
Mr. Mayor, I appreciate the attempt to stretch manufacturing to include the manufacturing of softwares. So of the expansion that's under contemplation, how much of that space is actually, what percentage of the expanded space is actually contemplated for use of software manufacturing, as you've just testified to?
I'm not with Thompson West, so and we're at this point asking for the opportunity to partner with them and talk more about the tax increment financing district. In terms of the physical proposal and how much of the space and or the jobs would specifically be involved in manufacturing technology, I think you need to ask Thompson West there. I think the suggestion I'm making is that when you develop software, when you serve clients with a virtual product, it is the same as manufacturing and making a product to go sell on a store shelf.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Mayor, I understand that. Let me restate that I appreciate you're trying to stretch the definition.
Surely.
But the tax agreement provisions are very strict, and what you're asking us to do is to give you a waiver to include or to expand that definition to something else. And so even if we were to grant that waiver to expand, say, software manufacturing under that definition, there would still have to be some attempt to meet that requirement of the 15%. So I think, I mean, I don't know about other members in the committee, but I would think that we should, we're also creating a precedent here. And I know that if we think about doing this, then we should try to really target and keep within the language of the TIF requirements in order that we're not opening a wide door for anyone else to come in. So, yes, if we're going to contemplate expanding the definition of manufacturing, then at least we ought to require that the manufacturing that's happening within the TIF district ought to still be within, you know, the 15%. And I, so I'm not sure if you're asking for just the 15% requirement to all go away or you're asking to include a new definition in manufacturing. And I think that if you know, if it's unfair to ask you this question, perhaps somebody from Thompson West is here who could answer that question.
And Chair and Senator, I can appreciate your concern. I think that what I'm asking for is the opportunity to work with Thompson on the economic, on the TIF district. If that's a consideration that you all need to make, then it may well be something that you should ask of Thompson West.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair and Senator Moore, one of the things that I've come to realize in this particular project is that we may have some obsolete language here because we really are manufacturing data bits. The raw material comes in on a wire and it leaves on a wire. It really is no different than something that comes in on a truck and leaves on a truck, just the fact that you can't pick it up and hold it in your hand. This is the future, is to be able to sell services, to sell data bits to people around the world. And this particular company has a very high reputation of this kind of product. Mainly, they do a value added to the information that comes in, and then they sell that value added back out of the company. It's not on a truck, but it is still adding something to the raw material that comes in. So there, and you're absolutely correct. This is a variation of the 15%. Or 85% that really needs to be factory floor. But this will be something that is the future for knowledge jobs. And it is probably leading and will lead us into what we need to do to relook at this law for other companies such as Thompson West if indeed we're going to be leading Minnesota into the 21st century and using more of the internet to distribute the products made here.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Carlson, I don't dispute that this is a very, it's a good place to go and it's where, you know, we as a state want to be. I'm just not quite sure if we could stretch the definition of manufacturing into to that extent. And I think that again, if it's the desire of this committee to help facilitate Thompson West and the deal that's happening there, I think that we ought to take a look at this. I have some concerns about moving in that direction because while Thompson West is engaged in an endeavor to achieve this complex in Eagan, there are a number of other businesses that could claim to be processing the same kind of products, could come in and say, that's manufacturing, as you know, you've been willing to consider for Thompson West. And I just have some concern that if we're moving in that direction, maybe we ought to rethink about what we consider manufacturing, because I'm not quite sure that to stretch the information repackaging as manufacturing is a little bit, it's kind of really stretching it a little bit.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sandra.
I guess, Mr. Chair and members, I don't have any problem with this. It's all about whether or not this facility is going to locate in Minnesota and whether it's going to locate in Eagan, and this organization has choices. We've got a community here it's not easy for a community to step up and accommodate these kind of infrastructure needs, and they're simply asking for a TIF district. It seemed fairly reasonable to me. you know, but before we do this, the organization may not come to Eagan or may not, for that matter, come to any other place in Minnesota. I don't see a big deal out of this. I think we, frankly, just ought to do it.
Anything else, members? Without objection, the chair lays over Senate File 1843 for possible inclusion. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and thank you, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Senator Sundrum? Senator Sundrum has Senate File 1281, a sales tax exemption in Rochester.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I have City Administrator Gary Newman with me to assist in the presentation. Maybe before I get into this, Mr. Chair, there is an amendment that brings this into conformity with what we have in the House, and I just wonder if we can have that passed out. And I would move adoption of that amendment. Simply includes within the sales tax exemption infrastructure related to the facility. Here they are, I'm sorry. So if I could, I'd move adoption of the amendment.
Council, does everybody have it? Council, can you explain what the amendment does?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The amendment would add to the existing language related infrastructure so that purchases made for related infrastructure would also be exempt. That is the largest change. The second change basically is more of a technical one that would add, would change the description of the building in terms of how it received its funding, but it doesn't really change the actual language. The big change is with the related infrastructure.
And Council, does this amendment change the fiscal note?
Mr. Chair, potentially it could change the fiscal note if revenue did not take into account what the cost of the infrastructure was. I just received the fiscal note, so I can't say if they took that into account or not.
Does anybody from revenue know, is the fiscal note drafted to the amended House file?
Mr. Chair, as far as I know, it's probably.
Mr. Newman?
I guess I don't know.
Chairman Bach, I believe it. It is accurate. The numbers they got from a person on my staff was the full cost for the two.
Okay, thank you. Senator Sundrum, what are we doing here?
Mr. Chair and members, this is, this is another one of those sales tax exemptions, and I have to try to make it somewhat unique. This is for a facility related to biobusiness. It's one that will work in concert with the University of Minnesota, the Mayo Partnership, Genomics Partnership, and the biosciences area. This particular facility, and I reference the picture that you may have in your packet, is immediately adjacent to the Mayo facilities, and frankly, it will connect to the facility that's going to be occupied by the University of Minnesota and Mayo. It's being funded largely out of state bonding capital investment proceeds. The city's going to put some significant dollars in it as well. Total cost of the facility, I believe, is around $37 million. About 25 of those are for construction. Again, it's all about trying to complement the biosciences industry in Minnesota to allow it to grow and prosper and to create jobs. And with that, I'll turn maybe the rest of the comments over to City Administrator Newman, and he can make any additional comments that perhaps need to be made here.
Senator Sundrum moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Bill is amended. Mr. Newman, welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Bach, members of the committee. The city views this project as a real partnership between the state and the city to try and see if we can grow bioscience and technology jobs in Minnesota. We received a bonding appropriation last year for the project. We're extending ourselves to put a lot of money into this. We're going to bond. The city will be bonding for the construction of the building. We're putting private enterprise funds revenues into the project. We're putting tax increment financing funds into the project as well. So at this point, you know, the plan is for a nine-story building. We'll have several floors of lease of space we have no commitments for that we're going to be trying to attract bioscience tenants for. The building is expandable by three floors. We hope to have essentially a business incubator to try and bring in bioscience companies to Minnesota. We've acquired the land for the site, but we have at this point kind of maximized our available resources, and we aren't quite to the bidding stage yet. We plan to bid the project in October of this year. So in that regard, we will be actively marketing this site at the Bio 2007 conference. That's an annual conference, national conference that the DEED folks go to and our city has gone to for the last 4 years to try and market Minnesota for bioscience jobs. So we'll be aggressively partnering with the state and trying to bring jobs to Minnesota. This sales tax exemption would help our budget, which is now at this point gotten pretty tight. But the project is going to proceed, and we appreciate the state's assistance in the project that we've had thus far, and we think we'll deliver an excellent project for you. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from members? Anybody else in the audience want to testify for or against Senate File 18? Oh, wrong number. Senate File 1281. Senator Lynch? Is this a good project?
Very good project.
Cost $1 million. It's easier to spend than to raise. Anything else, members? Mr. Newman, thank you for coming down. Without objection, the chair lays over Senate File 1281 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Members, that concludes our agenda for today. We'll be back tomorrow morning, bright and early, 8:30. This meeting's adjourned.